guys. Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Frisch, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Yeah. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is November 8, 2023. This panel of the court today has six cases on the calendar, three of which will be submitted with oral argument and three of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is case number A23-191, Fletcher Properties, Inc. and others versus City of Minneapolis and others. I believe counsel are familiar with our protocol. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. We've received correspondence from counsel for the city that respondents will, that all 15 minutes of respondents' time will be used by the city of Minneapolis. Thank you for the letter. Counsel for appellant, you may approach the lectern and please introduce yourself and your clients, and then you may begin.
May it please the court. My name is Tamara O'Neill Moreland with the law firm of Larkin Hoffman, and we represent the appellants in this matter. The takings clause under the Minnesota Constitution and the United States Constitution is a very simple rule. The government must pay for what it takes. The clause exists to prevent the government from forcing some people alone to bear the public burdens which, in all fairness and justice, must be borne by the public as a whole. The guarantee of the Minnesota Constitution is that private property shall not be taken, destroyed, or even damaged without just compensation. And this is a broader protection than the United States Constitution. But we find ourselves here with Minneapolis attempting to place the burden of affordable housing on the backs of a very small selection of property owners alone. They do this by changing the definition of discrimination in the city. They're changing the city's civil rights ordinance to include property owners who refuse to rent because they simply do not participate in a program because the requirements of the program are onerous, a legitimate business decision. And the city is using this changed definition to force owners to participate in a voluntary program at the federal level, the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program, and any other program existing now, existing in the future, regardless of its requirements, or the owners will be deemed to have discriminated against a tenant. Not against a program, against a tenant.
Council, let me ask this question. I want to acknowledge the burdens that the ordinance places on the landlords. I think those are fairly well detailed in your briefing. My question to you is how the burdens associated with ordinance, this ordinance, are meaningfully different than other burdens that a landlord bears by virtue of being a landlord. For example, an unlawful detainer. Someone's not paying rent. The landlord cannot exercise self-help to remove the person who's not paying rent from their premises. They're not invited. They're not wanted by the landlord. Is that also a taking? And if not, why is that government interference with the landlord's exercise of its will over its property any meaningfully different than this ordinance?
It's different on a couple of levels. Is it a taking? No.
Why not?
Because it is a regulation, not an appropriation of the right to exclude. They have invited the landlord, under the case law that currently exists, when you invite tenants into your property and you have chosen that tenant, you have certain duties to them and you have to follow regulations. And I don't think there's any landlords out there that think that they don't have to follow regulations.
Why isn't this also a regulation?
Because it takes it a step farther, which is you don't get to choose your tenants. You don't get to choose who comes onto your property and appropriates your property.
But why is that meaningfully different than like than an unlawful detainer? I don't want this tenant anymore. I don't want this tenant on my property anymore. I want to exclude this tenant.
Well, I think there was a New York case, Gallo, had recently came down that said it best. And what Gallo said was that a tenant that stops paying rent is different than a non-tenant because that person was invited. And you see that in many cases that have followed since Cedar Point Nursery, where, and a lot of them have been about states enacting eviction moratoriums during COVID. And a lot of the states have come down and said it's different in this case because they already lived there. Already were invited.
What about another provision of landlord-tenant law? 504B311 prevents discrimination based on familial status. So why is that any different than this kind of a regulation?
Well, and so does the MHRA. It says that you cannot discriminate based on public assistance. But the difference is that this isn't about discrimination. That's not changing based on the outcome of this case. What the state has defined as discrimination, making distinctions with the people that you're going to rent to, distinctions in the people themselves. This is different because it actually defines discrimination to include a non-discriminatory act. And the MHRA has said that when a landlord does something for legitimate business purposes, not because they're making a distinction based on the tenant, but for legitimate business purposes, and specifically, not participating in this voluntary federal program that comes with a lot of onerous requirements, it's not discrimination. It is making a decision for legitimate business purposes. And you see that in all, including the city's ordinance for things like employment. You know, an employer cannot discriminate, but they can make a decision based on a legitimate business purpose. And that's the difference here. We're redefining discrimination to include something that's not discrimination. And then saying...
Well, something that hasn't been previously defined as discrimination.
Correct.
But the city is now defining it as discrimination.
They're defining it as discrimination, but it has nothing to do... Discrimination has always been about intent. Intent to discriminate. This has nothing to do with intent.
I'm not so sure about that, but...
Just if you don't participate in this program because you don't like the requirements of the program, then you have discriminated. And that is different than refusing to rent to somebody because of their color, their sex. You know, that has an intent that goes to the human. Where this is about basically discriminating against a program. And it's important to remember that this is a voluntary federal program for a reason. There is a give and take in this program, and that's what the Supreme Court has allowed in cases like Horn, where you can have a give and take. You can say that I will give up certain rights because I'm going to get this benefit. But that doesn't mean that just because your industry is regulated, you leave your constitutional rights at the door. Just because you have to comply with certain inspection and safety qualifications to have people live there, that you have now laid all your constitutional rights down and the government can come in and take whatever property they want whenever they want.
And these arguments that you're making right now, they go to the question of whether a regulatory taking occurred, right?
It's no, because just because something is a regulation doesn't automatically put it in the bucket of regulatory taking. Cedar Point Nursery did a really nice job of laying that out, probably for the first time in really clear language, that any time the result is that the government is saying you need to allow this person on your property, that is a per se appropriation of property. It's okay. Not a right regulatory taking.
So then let's go back to the unlawful detainer. That's exactly what an unlawful detainer is. The government is saying you must allow this person on your property.
You must allow them on the property until you give them due process.
Which could take a long time.
It can take a long time, but it is just due process. You invited them, like I said, the courts have decided that once you invite a tenant in, you owe them more responsibility than somebody you haven't invited onto your property.
And how is that consistent with the more absolute principle that you're articulating in Cedar Point, or you're claiming that Cedar Point stands for? Are you saying that Cedar Point and Yee are entirely inconsistent?
I am not saying that they're inconsistent.
And are you saying that Yee is not good law?
I am saying that Yee is not good law in the state of Minnesota. Yee has not been, it was referenced quickly in one of our state appellate courts, and the Eighth Circuit has specifically said that it stopped relying on Yee when Horn came down.
I wonder because why that is, because him. Cedar Point cites to Yee.
It does.
So you're not taking the position that the Supreme Court is no longer considering Yee to be good law, are you?
No.
U.S. Supreme Court.
No, and I don't think the Eighth Circuit said it's not good law. I think what it said is that Horn goes into more detail of what that means.
So why wouldn't Minnesota adopt the principles set forth in Yee? What is it about Yee that is antithetical to the Minnesota Constitution or the principles that are already embedded in Minnesota law?
As it relates to this case, Yee stands for the same principle that we've been talking about. Once you invite a tenant into your property, you owe them different duties. But what Yee doesn't say is that you can force somebody to rent to somebody else, because the tenants in Yee were all there. And it was a rent stabilization type ordinance where it was talking about how much you could raise the rent. And that is completely outside, I think, of what we're talking about in this case, because these tenants aren't there. They're being forced to be there, which is the line that Cedar Point was drawing. Once they're there, there are regulations that a landlord has to follow. There are due process you have to give before you evict somebody. But when the government tells you who you have to rent to, which is much different than saying that you can't discriminate in your renting to people and you have to be fair to people. It's saying that even if you're being fair, even if you have no ill intent, you have to start participating in a program that requires you to enter into contracts with the government, have the MPHA involved in the sale of your property, override your lease provisions. You have to start doing something totally different and rent to people and treat them differently than you do the rest of your tenants.
I'd like to ask, Judge Kirk, did you have a question? I'd like to ask a sort of a general question, which is, speaking for myself, I thought the district judge's order was very well written, very thorough, it seemed to take a relatively straightforward approach to the existing case law. And that's just a comment, and that doesn't mean there's no error. I mean, that's my first impression. Where would you say is the weakest weak spot in the district court's analysis? I mean, if you were, I know you're making a broad argument, you're preserving a lot of issues, I understand that, but if you were to point us to something, you know, the issue or sub-issue that you think is where the best opportunity for you to obtain reversal, what would that be?
The issue that I would point out to you is the fact that the judge decided simply because landlords rent property in general, they have invited people onto their land, and therefore it's not forcing an appropriation. That is not consistent with the cases that have come down. First of all, in Minnesota,
following Cedar Point,
even before Cedar Point, because in Minnesota, rental property is not open to the public. It's considered private property. And using cases like Pruneyard, which is a California case that dealt with the common areas of an outdoor mall, first of all, a mall is not residential rental property. And in Minnesota, malls, actually private malls, have been treated as private property where you can prevent things like leafletting. And even in California, Pruneyard's jurisdiction, apartment complexes are not considered open to the public. So these are private properties. Also, when the cases have been really clear that even when you regulate something doesn't mean that you have carte blanche to take away people's constitutional rights. So this idea that just because landlords rent to people, they have somehow are not allowed the same protections. Laredo says that's not true. Horn says that's not true. So that's the issue. It's the taking it one step further and looking at ye for what ye is, which is it's about current tenants and regulations, as opposed to do you lay down all your rights just because you've decided to rent your property?
Thank you. It appears there are no further questions at this time. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal argument.
Thank you.
Counsel for Respondent City, you may approach. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Kristen Sarf with the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office on behalf of the City of Minneapolis, and Jack Kahn from the Housing Justice Center and Lawrence McDonough from Homeline are also here today. The city passed an amendment to its civil rights ordinance to expand upon the protections that were offered to housing choice voucher holders under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Protections that go to housing choice vouchers that are largely consisted of protected class members. 41% are households headed by women, 53% include children, 78 are families headed by women, 41% are households that include someone with a disability, and 85.4% are people of color. The district court granted the city summary judgment because all of the issues, the takings and the preemption claims, could be resolved purely on legal issues. The district court's decision was, in fact, well-reasoned. It was based upon consistent, existing, long well-established case law that says that a use regulation on property that's open to the public does not affect a constitutional taking as long as the regulation doesn't go too far and impose a severe economic harm.
And talk to us about, can share with us why a landlord's property is open to the public in the traditional sense. The point is well taken that the landlord's property, just because it rents to specific tenants, doesn't mean that anybody can walk onto the property or use the property. So why is it open to the public?
It's open to the public because the only way a housing choice voucher holder is even applying is because the landlord or the owner has put out an advertisement saying, come submit an application and live in our home. That's the invitation. This the ordinance doesn't say
that's an open to the public to apply to be on the premises, but that's a little different than an open invitation, come one, come all. It's not like a shopping mall. It's not like a park. It's not like any other open public space.
I guess I want to start on the back end. If the court determines that rental properties are not open to the public, then there are longstanding huge ramifications to that decision that rental properties are not open to the public. Because make no mistake about it, this ordinance is about discrimination. If it is true that rental properties are not open to the public, then the Minnesota Human Rights Act and every Fair Housing Act a protection that says you can't reject tenants because you don't like their race, you don't like their gender, you don't like their familial status, all of those become takings because you can only get to the holding the appellants want you to if you first determine that rental properties are not open to the public.
I understand the argument, okay. Counsel. I think what I'm looking for is for you to define for us what does it mean to be open to the public? What does that characteristic look like? How do we define what that is?
Well, so what Yi says is that the central character is whether or not there's acquiescence in what you're being forced to. And the rent stabilization case, which relies upon Yi, explains that the central question is whether an owner is forced to allow a particular type of occupation and not whether the owner is required to accept a particular tenant. So the reason why that matters to the public delineation is because when the rental property owners invite applicants, they're not inviting people, you're right, to just come and sit in their lobbies. They're not saying, come do trunk or treat in our parking lot. It's not open in that way. But it's open in the type of occupation, the type of use that the ordinance encompasses. It says, to the extent you are renting your property, you have made that rental open to the public. And so the ordinance doesn't seek to open the rental properties in a non-traditional setting. And that's why rent stabilization and Yi say, you have to focus upon the occupation or the use that's being put to the property. And I just want to say that the Yi case, one of the things that the appellant's counsel keeps saying is that the Yi case is just about existing tenants, and it's not. The Yi case, and we've all cited to lots of different cases that give their own interpretation of the Yi case, and I would encourage the court to read the case on its own. What the Yi case relates to is both the ability to evict existing tenants and the ability of those existing tenants to pass along their interests to next of kin when they leave or depart, which means that it relates to future existing tenants. So the Yi case wasn't just about, we can create these bright lines between whether or not you're an existing tenant versus a future tenant. It applies to both. And what the court said was that the mobile park owners opened their properties to that particular use, housing. And so the fact that they have a limitation on the ability to evict or to allow certain tenants in doesn't impact a per se physical taking. And I guess what I'd say is, as you're considering the cases that are put in front of you, appellant's counsel asks you to rely upon the Horn case. The Horn case is the Raisin case. It's the physical appropriation, the setting aside of raisins in which the government gets to use it for however it wants. And of course, the raisin growers do get to retain an interest in the proceeds from that. But that's a physical appropriation case. And that is demonstrably different than and infinitely less specific than the Yi case and the rent stabilization case, because both of those are specific to use of property that was intended to be used for living arrangements. So when the ordinance goes into effect, it is in effect, the property owners aren't putting any new use to their property. The people are living in the bedrooms the same way any other market tenant would. They're cooking in the kitchen the same way any other tenant would. There's no different use to their property. What the appellant's counsel tells you is there's a distinction between, for example, the unlawful detainer, because the housing choice voucher holders weren't invited in. And there's a fundamentally different kind of milieu to it, because the other provisions relate to discrimination. And I will just say that the Minnesota Supreme Court, while admittedly has not ruled explicitly on the taking claim or the preemption claims that are before the court, in order to reach the holding that the appellants want you to reach, you would still have to disregard very clear dicta that says that the purpose of this amendment is to address discrimination, and that there's more than one logical way to address discrimination. And the reason why that is because under the MHRA, it is true, it's currently voluntary that people can decide whether or not they want to participate in the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program. But what that means is any landlord, in order to be compliant with the MHRA, the only thing they have to say is, I didn't like the requirements of the program. Absent being able to present evidence of direct discrimination, meaning there's an email saying we don't like Section 8 tenants, we think, you know, we have animosity against you for some reason, there's no capacity to come back against that. So what the Minnesota Supreme Court recognized is that there's more than one lawful way to try to address that type of discrimination, and that's this ordinance. That's what the Edwards Court, the Court of Appeals decision, said, is that what's needed to address this specific issue of the program requirements being inhibitor to granting additional housing is there needs to be specific language. And the city adopted that lawful language, and what you have before you, Your Honors, is four arguments about why they think that a different method of attempting to address discrimination is improper. The first is the physical taking, which we've addressed. The second is the regulatory taking claim. And right off the bat, they can't succeed in that claim because the very data that they submit to you in two expert reports shows that there were multiple instances of housing choice voucher holder properties that rent to housing choice voucher holders outperforming those that reject them. Out of the two attempts at expert reports, there are 5 out of 16 properties that accept voucher holders outperforming those that don't. And on a facial challenge, they cannot succeed on a Penn Central taking where a third of the examples that they set forth show that there was no severe economic harm. And they can't succeed on the severe economic harm, which is the primary factor under Penn Central, because the percentages that they quantify as being the harm, which are always less than 30%, no court of law anywhere in the United States of America outside of cases that relate to airport regulations and the flyover, which Minnesota has a separate test for, no court in the United States has ever found a regulatory taking as low as 30%. The Second Circuit said we haven't seen anything less than 50%.
Well, I'd like to switch topics. Slightly, but going back to the earlier comments about the voluntariness of the program, I guess I'm not so familiar with the program, but is it possible for a landlord to, I mean, I understood it's deemed voluntary, right? I mean, a landlord need not participate in the program. Once a landlord is in the program, is it possible for the landlord to withdraw and thereby avoid the entire ordinance?
Yes. So the ordinance says that there are certain properties that are exempted right off the bat. For example, people who are in the military that are no longer living in their homes and renting out the program. So there's 4 lawful exceptions that the Minnesota Supreme Court has already approved. Then the ordinance also says if a landlord can come forward and show that there will be an undue hardship by participating in the program, they are exempted from it.
Exempted from with respect to a particular tenant, right?
That's true.
Okay, but my question is different, I guess. My question is, I mean, if a landlord is presently in the program before the ordinance takes effect or when it took effect, I mean, it's been stayed, right? Or it's been temporarily enjoined?
It's enforced right now.
It is being, okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's say even after the effective date of the ordinance, may a private landlord say, I no longer wish to be in this particular business or this segment of residential rental properties. I wish to, you know, I'm gonna redevelop my property into something that's different and does not participate. May a landlord do that?
Yes, because what the ordinance says is that the requirements of the Housing Choice Voucher Program cannot be a motivating factor. So if a property owner decided, I want to all of a sudden, you know, run an art cooperative out of my apartment building, or I'm going to sell it to a business that's going to turn into an optometrist, those are lawful because the requirements of the Housing Choice Voucher Program was not the motivating factor.
But what if the landlord simply wants to charge market rents? What if the landlord yeah. wants to upgrade the building to luxury apartments and thereby not be in the program? Is that possible?
That is possible. What they can't do is
it is possible. I mean, it's without any. It's a unilateral decision the landlord can make.
They can charge $10,000 a month, but they can't just say to Housing Choice Voucher holders, we're charging you $10,000 a month, right? If they decided that they wanted it to become a luxury apartment and everything's a penthouse and they want to charge all of the prospective tenants $10,000 a month, they can do that, and they can be out of the program entirely. They can also prove the undue hardship. They can also move out of renting because they have some alternative purpose, which doesn't use the Housing Choice Voucher Program as a motivating factor. So, and most applicable, they can terminate contracts for good cause.
What would be an example of that?
Of which?
What you just said, they have alternatives to move out. What are they?
So for example, if someone has a fourplex and they had originally put up the fourth unit for rent, and then all of a sudden their mother-in-law is moving into town and they decide they're going to let the mother-in-law live in that rental unit, then rejecting Housing Choice Voucher Holder, the program requirements weren't the motivating factor. If they decided we did upgrade and we can charge more and it's $5,000, $6,000, whatever amount it is now, and that doesn't fall into the categories or the payment range of the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority, then it's not subject to the program.
What's the top end of that range now?
I can't say. I could write a letter giving you that number if it's important.
It's not that important.
Okay, but just to clarify, the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority and the Housing Choice Voucher Holder Program does allow properties to charge market rent. Under no circumstances is someone going in and saying any other applicant is renting at $3,000 a month, but we expect it for $1,800 a month. That doesn't happen. Now, what my colleague's going to tell you is, well, if they want to increase rent, the MPHA has to approve rent increases. But the record before you on this facial challenge where they have to prove every single application will be unconstitutional, there's not a single instance in the record of the MPHA ever denying a rent increase. There's no example of that. There are examples of the MPHA affirmatively proving those rent increases. So it stays concurrent with what appellants refer to as the market rate. I see a red light going off. If I could just say for a moment, I do note that the appellant's counsel did not mention anything about the other respondents' participation in the argument, and so we would rest largely on the briefs on that. But I would just briefly say that in the briefs, there's nothing in the record to indicate that the plaintiffs were unable to present some material argument that was necessary to respond to the respondents' home line and Housing Justice Center. And given that the district court had a two-hour summary judgment hearing, everybody had a full and opportunity to be heard on all the merits of the claims. If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them, to the best of my ability, at least. And thank you for your time. We ask that you affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Sarf. Counsel for appellant, you may present rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, just before you start in, I just want to clarify, are you claiming there is any dispute of genuine genuine dispute of material fact that precludes summary judgment, or are we all, and if so, what is that?
If the only time there would be a genuine issue of material fact is if we get to the point of what is just compensation. But otherwise, I'm not claiming that there's a genuine issue of material fact.
Okay, thank you very much.
I think as a community, we want to look the other way because affordable housing is important to all of us. But this is not the same as a due process case. The courts have said that a strong public desire to improve the public condition does not warrant achieving the desire by a shorter cut than the constitutional way of paying for the change. The idea of denying discrimination defining discrimination to include an owner's decision not to participate in a program for non-discriminatory legitimate business reasons, and then a claim that we are opposing that change in definition, and that opposition somehow is going to unravel civil rights for everybody in the state of Minnesota, is really a smokescreen. What we're talking about here is looking at the truth of the fact that the way they have changed their ordinance is not actually defining a discriminatory act. And what they're asking for are these tenants to be treated differently than current tenants, because these tenants require many different things, and that's why the program at the federal level is voluntary. This idea that ye applied somehow greater to say that if you're in a regulated industry, if you rent your property, then we can tell you who to rent to. That it did not say that, and if it had, it would have overturned Laredo, because Laredo was very specific that the argument in Laredo was that because an owner decided to rent their property, then they lost some constitutional rights. And the Laredo court said that a landlord's ability to rent their property may not be conditioned on them forfeiting the right to compensation for a physical occupation. I would like to touch briefly on undue hardship. Undue hardship is not an exemption to this ordinance. It is an affirmative defense. The only time it can be raised is after a landlord has been accused of discrimination, and the whole process goes forward, and they can raise as a affirmative defense in that one situation that it was an undue hardship for them to participate in the program. That is not like any kind of screening ordinance which allows a landlord to make a decision about a tenant. It is not a situation where a landlord is really making any decision at all. The city then decides whether it's undue hardship in this one particular provision.
But that would be precipitated by a landlord denying a prospective tenant the ability to rent the property. So there would be some decision that is made by the landlord that would precipitate a discrimination claim and then the defense of undue hardship, as I understand it. Am I misunderstanding the way that that works?
But you have to, in order to claim undue hardship, you have to take the risk of being found to have discriminated, which puts your license on the line. It's not a prospective thing where you go to the city and say, listen, I have this small apartment building, I can't do this, I don't have the staff. That's not how it works. You have to put your license on the line and say, I'm not going to rent to you. And then if you pursue a claim for discrimination, then I'm going to tell the city all of these things, why I can't do it, why it's undue hardship, and then I roll the dice on my license. That's not the same as an exemption. It's not the same as making an actual decision. We shouldn't have to put landlords in a position where they're faced with discriminatory charges and their license being on the line simply to try to say, listen, I can't afford this, which is why many landlords don't actually participate in that program.
Counselor, is there any case law finding or a regulatory taking on a sort of before the fact, on an action to enjoin or, you know, we don't have any evidence in the record here about your clients, the financial performance of the properties, right? I think you're making kind of an abstract argument about what is likely to occur in the future.
Right. And regulatory takings are often before the fact because under the law, the act of when you enact the ordinance is when you take. Now, the amount of compensation is not whether you took, it's just the amount of just compensation.
Is it possible to determine a taking without knowing the diminution in value or other sort of, you know, the proportion of the harm?
There is. It is absolutely, you can say that there is a taking. To actually say what the consequence of that taking is, what is the just compensation, then you need more. That's why just compensation is a trial issue, not a summary judgment issue.
And can you point to examples in the case law, perhaps like the U.S. Supreme Court cases? I mean, in other words, off the top of your head, are any of those leading cases of the U.S. Supreme Court about regulatory takings, are any of those cases on sort of a pre-enforcement level as opposed to, you know, a case that had evidence about the actual harms after the fact?
I would be guessing.
Yeah.
But I think I should be able to.
Well, that's...
I would be guessing.
Yeah.
They are all very clear. There's a whole line of cases that I've cited to in our briefing that talk about the fact of it's, you know, when a government moves onto your property and says, I'm going to take this I'm going to develop a park on here, that moving onto the property is a taking, obviously.
I understand a physical per se taking, but a regulatory taking, I think it seems like it requires evidence of the financial consequences.
It doesn't require specific evidence for the determination of whether there was a taking. It requires evidence, I would just refer you to the brief on that because there's a bunch of cases we cited where it talks about the fact that because the taking occurs the moment the ordinance is enacted, that's the taking. And that's what you're determining of whether it's lawful. Now, if it's unlawful, the just compensation needs to be proved on a case-by-case basis.
I think your time has expired, so you may sum up.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would ask that the court reverse the district court. We agree that the district court wrote a very nice opinion, but we do think the district court missed the application of Yee, the way apartment complexes are determined already in Minnesota to not be public accommodations. It's not going to be a new law. They're already determined not to be public accommodations. And that needs to be looked at because this court has never relied on Yee. The Eighth Circuit has said that we look more at Horn than Yee because Horn has a balancing that you need to consider. And so we're asking this court to do the same.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both attorneys for your excellent arguments, both written and oral. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.
Thank you.